You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. What do you do with so-called problem kids in a classroom, the ones who are always acting out and giving other kids a hard time and sometimes even getting violent? It turns out that there are win-win solutions for the kids, for the classroom, the teachers, the students, and the whole community. We're going to be hearing about all that from Dr. Ross Green right after these brief messages. Support for the Radio Cafe comes from the Lannan Foundation, presenting a reading and conversation by Deborah Levy with Jonathan Freeman on Wednesday, October 30th at 7 o'clock at the Lensic. Deborah Levy is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and writes fiction, plays, and poetry. The author of beloved books including Hot Milk and Swimming Home, both Man Booker Prize finalists, and Things I Don't Want to Know, her latest novel is The Man Who Saw Everything, longlisted for the 2019 Booker Prize. Tickets available at the Lensic, 988-1234, or lensic.org. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Elevating interest and opportunities in STEM, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks the Lannan Foundation for their sponsorship of this show. I'm very happy now to welcome Dr. Ross Green. He's a child psychologist who was on the faculty of Harvard Medical School for over 20 years and is now director and founder of the nonprofit Lives in the Balance, livesinthebalance.org. He's the author of several books, including Lost at School, The Explosive Child, and Raising Human Beings, and his work is featured in the documentary The Kids We Lose. He will be in New Mexico giving a free community forum on classroom discipline, along with Albuquerque attorney Gail Stewart, titled Beyond Punishment. That's at 6 o'clock on Monday, the 14th of October, at the forum at the University of New Mexico Law School. Welcome, Dr. Green, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So we're talking today about the most difficult kids in our school systems and how to keep them on a path so that they're not lost to violence and prison and drugs and so on. But I wanted to ask you first, it seems like there are a lot more kids with what we call behavior problems, kids who are angry, explosive, otherwise difficult. Is this true? And if it is true, why?
It seems to be true. There's a lot of people who've been in education for a very long time who tell me that it's true. I think that it's a complex question. There's no single answer. I can pluck a few for you. I think there's a lot more pressure on kids and educators these days. I think that educators are pressured by high-stakes testing and in many places still zero-tolerance policies and budgets that have been cut and classrooms that have too many kids in them. There's a lot of pressure on teachers and there's a lot of pressure on kids. We are expecting more from kids at earlier and earlier ages, and as you raise the bar on what you expect from kids, you can expect more to fall off the apple cart. Because given developmental variability, the higher your expectations are, and I'm not adverse to high expectations, I just think that our expectations need to be developmentally sensitive. What can kids actually do and at what ages? Simply thinking that it's great to raise the bar, which I guess looks good to some folks, doesn't look good to me when the bar is being raised to the point that a higher and higher percentage of kids are unable to get over the bar. So I think schools are, quite frankly, pressure cookers these days. My definition of the quality of a school is the degree to which it handles the developmental variability that is guaranteed to be walking in the door well. And a lot of schools don't. I think that those are some of the reasons. There's a lot more that are related to families and the fact that it takes two incomes to create the lifestyle that one income used to, which means that parents are tired and kids are getting less parenting. There's just a whole host of things that have worked to the disadvantage of kids that have occurred over the last 20 to 30 years.
There's another piece too, which is that there used to be a kind of a segregation between special education kids and the others, and now they're put together, but the training that teachers need to integrate the special ed kids, quote unquote, isn't necessarily there.
Yeah, we still haven't gotten over inclusion. And truth is, I'm a big fan of inclusion. I think that including kids who have developmental differences is a wonderful idea. But as I said in the film, only under one condition, and that is you prepare classroom teachers for what's coming. And we did not do a very good job of that. And quite frankly, in many respects, we still don't.
The way kids are handled now in school is absolutely shocking if you start to look into it. There are millions of children who are suspended, hundreds of thousands who are physically beaten by school personnel, referred to police, arrested, expelled. Innumerable kids getting physically restrained, like literally tied up. One of those devices that I saw in your film looks like a crucifix with children's arms and legs being tied down to this sort of cross thing. They're sometimes thrown by themselves into rooms, even closets. What does this do to kids and their futures?
Well, it's not good. It doesn't fix anything. It doesn't solve the problems that are causing the behaviors that we're doing these things to them about in the first place. So the whole thing is counterproductive, but perhaps the most counterproductive piece of it is that we are manhandling kids. We are sending them an interesting message about the capacity of the adults in their lives to help them. But the main issue is that because those interventions really don't address the factors that are causing the kids' behavior in the first place, those factors continue to be unaddressed. So not only are we doing something extremely counterproductive and in many instances harmful, we're also not really addressing what's really getting in their way. So things don't ever get any better. So there are kids who just keep getting thrown into seclusion rooms and getting restrained and getting suspended, none of which address the factors that are causing their challenging behavior in the first place. So not only are you doing things that are counterproductive, you're not fixing anything. And eventually, these kids lose hope, lose faith in us adults. Their behavior tends to worsen. The problems that are causing their behavior remains unsolved. And then a few really expensive and not good outcomes occur. They either drop out, in which case they are costing society a lot of money, or they end up in a special education placement, which costs a school system a great deal of money, all because we were intervening in ways that were not only counterproductive, but also distinctly unhelpful.
You really make the case that discipline and punishment do not work. And your work really challenges that by providing an alternative model, which is called CPS, Collaborative and Proactive Solutions. Talk about that model, CPS.
Well, Collaborative and Proactive Solutions is where we are helping adults and kids solve problems together. And those are the problems that are causing their challenging behavior. The together part is important because so often we adults try to solve those problems all on our own. In this model, you've got a partner, the kid. Proactive in part is important because we are trying to get adults out of the heat of the moment. The heat of the moment is where a lot of the bad stuff we do to these kids occurs. But a huge part of the model is instead of having adults focus on a kid's challenging behavior, which in the CPS model is just the signal, just the fever. Behavior is just the means by which a kid is communicating that he or she is stuck, that there are expectations he or she is having difficulty meeting. Those unmet expectations in the CPS model we call unsolved problems, and CPS is a problem-solving model. A lot of the counterproductive interventions that are applied to kids are counterproductive because they're only focused on the signal, the fever, the kid's behavior. And in this model, we are going deeper and focusing on the problems that are causing the behavior. Now, a huge piece of that is that those problems are actually highly predictable. And if we identify them proactively, then they can be solved proactively. And then we almost never find ourselves in the position of having to de-escalate a kid or lay hands on him. But there's a very long list of interventions that do not solve any of the problems that are causing this kid's challenging behavior. Here's the short list: detention, suspension, expulsion, paddling, restraint, seclusion, stickers. These are not interventions that are aimed at solving problems. They are interventions that are only aimed at modifying behavior if behavior is just the signal, then those interventions are not only not getting the job done, but they're also focused on exactly the wrong thing.
I mean, one of the central principles of your model, CPS, is that kids do well if they can. They rarely, if ever, want to be bad. They're not intentionally trying to disrupt. But there's barriers in the way of their doing well. So what are some of these main barriers and how do you address them?
Well, the main thing the research tells us about what's getting in the way for kids with social, emotional, and behavioral challenges is that they are lacking important skills. And those skills are in the general domains of flexibility, adaptability, frustration tolerance, problem solving. Once you know that, and that's what the research that's accumulated over the last 40 to 50 years tells us, and that's not just a few studies, by the way, that's a mountain of research, then a lot of things we've been thinking about these kids no longer make any sense because they weren't true in the first place. Attention-seeking, manipulative, coercive, unmotivated, limit testing. And if those explanations make sense, then the interventions that those explanations lead us to, which is primarily rewarding and punishing, may not make any sense either. Rewarding and punishing are behavior modification strategies. And the research tells us that rewarding and punishing is effective at reducing challenging behavior. But rewarding and punishing is not effective at solving the problems that are causing that challenging behavior. What the research also tells us is that when you are solving problems collaboratively and proactively, not only are you improving the behavior every bit as much as you would have if you were trying to modify it, you are also solving the problems that are causing that behavior. And perhaps best of all, you are simultaneously, just by solving problems collaboratively and proactively with kids, teaching them a lot of the skills that they are lacking. It's what I sometimes refer to as a 3-for-1 sale. That's what the research tells us about kids with behavioral challenges. They're lacking skills. They have expectations they are having difficulty meeting. Our interventions should be focused on helping them meet those expectations, not through rewarding and punishing, but through solving problems collaboratively and proactively. And when you're doing that, you are simultaneously teaching the kid the skills he or she is lacking, and you are improving the kid's behavior every bit as much as you would have if you were only focused on the kid's behavior.
One of the insights of your work, which made so much sense to me, and it's so, you know, it's like somebody wrote a book called Everything is Obvious Once You Know the Answer. And this is one of those things. Mm. Like you, when you think about when a kid is slow in reading, you give them extra help on reading. Well, when a kid is slow in impulse control, you give them extra help on impulse control. It's the same kind of thing. A kid is lacking skills, you help them, except we do it with reading and we don't do it necessarily with impulse control. What does the CPS model that you use actually look like when it's being used by teachers? Like, walk us through a real life type of example.
Well, there's an instrument that we use called the Assessment of Lagging Skills and Unsolved Problems. And what it helps educators and parents and anybody else who's using it, we've used it in prisons and in inpatient psychiatry units and in residential facilities too. No matter where you're using this model, you've got to figure out what a kid's lagging skills and unsolved problems are first. That's how you help make intervention almost totally proactive. The lagging skills is to help you get the right lenses on, and the unsolved problems are to help you know what problems need to be solved. In a school, that process of identifying lagging skills and unsolved problems takes place usually in a meeting. These meetings take place already, and about 50 to 55 minutes to figure out what has never been figured out before about this kid, more likely than not, what are his lagging skills, what are his unsolved problems. So in these meetings, we are not talking about our theories about how this kid got to be this way. That's a waste of time. We are not talking about psychiatric diagnoses. Psychiatric diagnoses don't really tell you what a particular kid's lagging skills and unsolved problems are. We are not talking about behavior. That's just the signal. And we are not talking about solutions because the kid is not in the meeting and the problem-solving piece of this model is supposed to be collaborative. Nope. The adults are going to figure out what the kid's lagging skills and unsolved problems are, and then we are going to prioritize, because especially in the case of kids who've been getting in trouble for a very long time, they are likely to have a very long list of lagging skills and unsolved problems. So we have to prioritize which unsolved problems are we going to start working on first with this kid. Can't work on them all at once. And then we are going to embark on the process of solving those problems collaboratively and proactively with this kid. We are going to get classroom teachers out of the heat of the moment. These problems are identifiable proactively and they are solvable proactively. The problem-solving process itself consists of three steps. The first step is the empathy step. This is where the caregiver is gathering information from the kid about what's making it hard for the kid to meet a particular expectation. Second step is called the define adult concerns step. This is where the adult is verbalizing why it's important for that expectation to be met. And in the third step, adult and child are collaborating on a solution that will address the concerns that were identified in those first two steps. Because problems are highly predictable, because we can identify them proactively, they can be solved proactively. My mantra is, once you figure out what a kid's lagging skills and unsolved problems are, there are very few surprises left, and intervention can be 99.9% proactive. Now, if we contrast that with the discipline program that exists in many schools, then, boy, there's quite the difference, because in many schools, intervention is primarily occurring in the heat of the moment in the form of a discipline referral. This is where classroom teachers are sending their problems to somebody else, often the principal or assistant principal or a school counselor or a school psychologist, for somebody else to do something about the problem. In this model, the person who is best for solving a problem with a kid is the person whose expectation the kid is having difficulty meeting in the first place. And that's usually the classroom teacher. Now, at a very practical level, that is always going to raise the issue, when does he think we're going to do that? And time tends to be the four-letter word that plagues all new initiatives in every school. Number one, valid concern, because teachers are very busy. Number two, it's an unsolved problem for the school. How are we in our school going to give classroom teachers the time they need to solve problems with their kids? It is a problem that many, many schools that we have worked with have created mechanisms for solving. First of all, we help them find what we call buried time. Sometimes that's before school, sometimes after. Sometimes it's during lunch, sometimes during recess, sometimes it's during the teacher's prep time if the teacher has prep time. But we also help them create mechanisms for providing coverage so that classroom teachers have time to solve problems with their kids. Now, the good news is this. Ultimately, this model saves time.
Right.
Given the amount of time people are spending dealing with these kids in the heat of the moment, this model is not going to take more time. It's going to save time, which means that ultimately we find that time is not really the issue. Making the commitment to solving problems with kids is the issue. When schools make that commitment, they find the time.
We're talking to Dr. Ross Green. We'll be back in just a half a minute. The Lensic and Outpost Performance Space present the legendary Chick Corea Trilogy on October 8th, featuring the 22-time Grammy Award winner Chick Corea with powerhouse bassist Christian McBride and drummer extraordinaire Brian Blade to form this stellar trio. Trilogy includes reinventions of classic Korea compositions, previously unrecorded originals, and an array of jazz standards recognized with two Grammy Awards. Get tickets today at lensic.org. So, in a given classroom, is there any typical percentage of kids? Is it usually like one kid, or is it sometimes half the kids in a classroom who are acting out? Because it seems like, you know, in your book, Lost in School, which I read with great interest, you kind of profile one kid who seems probably like a composite that you've put together from your work, but the teacher spends extra time with this kid in a way that works for the kid and really does solve his problems. That's one. What if there's five? Or does that not, like, what does that look like?
Well, first of all, how many there are in a classroom totally depends on that classroom, often that neighborhood, that school. Some classroom teachers feel like they only have one who's acting up and expressing the fact that he or she is having difficulty meeting certain expectations in ways that are big. But many classroom teachers will tell you that the whole class feels that way. And what this requires is taking a look at our expectations, because remember, it's our expectations that are getting this whole ball rolling in the first place. If a kid can meet the expectation, you're not going to see challenging behavior. So number one, if we have a lot of these kids in the classroom, we're going to have to take a look at our expectations. And by the way, high-stakes testing did not make looking at our expectations any easier, because high-stakes testing told us we need to have the exact same expectations for every kid. Right. And you know what? If that was the typical classroom, that would be fantastic. But my experience tells me that's not the typical classroom. Luckily, good teaching, differentiated instruction, personalized learning is all about making sure that every kid gets what they need. The truth is, there are many kids in the classroom who are having difficulty meeting certain expectations but are not communicating that in ways that are big. They're just putting their head in their desk and not doing anything the whole class. They are just sitting there doing nothing. They may be pouting or withdrawing. Those kids actually often slip through the cracks quite a bit because they're still having difficulty meeting expectations. They're just not doing it in a way that is powerful and big. Bottom line is, we need to make sure that the expectations for every kid in this classroom are appropriate for what's walking in the door. But here's the interesting thing. These problems didn't accumulate overnight. If we're doing this in a lot of classrooms, starting at very early ages, that we are not continuing to kick the can down the road so that by the time a kid gets to high school, if he actually gets to high school, he doesn't have 50 unsolved problems on his list because we've been busy solving them at every step along the way. The reason we have so many kids in a classroom who have so many difficulties is because they aren't getting solved, because we are over-relying on traditional discipline, rewarding and especially punishing, to try to help these kids. And as I said earlier, there's not a single problem that will be solved through an adult-imposed consequence. Those are behavior modification strategies. They are not problem-solving strategies.
I think it's really interesting that, I mean, I can totally understand how punishment doesn't work on a kid who doesn't have certain skills or who is traumatized or who's got troubles at home. Or, I mean, in New Mexico, there's continual conversation about the fact that so many kids are challenged by, you know, poverty and substance abuse and all kinds of things, and you punish them, it doesn't help. But the flip side of that, reward doesn't help either. Explain that.
Well, rewards are cut from the exact same bolt of cloth as punishment. They are both motivational strategies, and motivation is not what these kids need more of. The other interesting thing, given the point that you were making, is that there are many kids in schools who come from less than ideal home situations who are actually doing just fine at school. I find that we often get distracted by what's going on at home. Not that what's going on at home is irrelevant, just that the folks at school may not be in the ideal position to do much about it. But as I always say, the folks at school are in an ideal position to make sure that when they have their kid in their building, 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, 9 months a year, they're in a very good position to do something about what the kid's experience is during that time. We can give the kid a very positive experience the whole day. And if people are wondering, yeah, but if he's going home to something that is less than ideal, doesn't it cancel out what we're doing at school? The answer is no. There are many kids who are going home to situations that are less than ideal who are doing just fine in school.
Right. Well, and in every class with problem kids, there are many what we might call ordinary non-problem kids. And, you know, they are also part of the solution. How do you envision, or how do you see actually working classrooms where everyone's working together collaboratively, kids at all levels?
Well, there's a few answers to that. First of all, I don't slice the pie by who's a problem and who's not. Here's how I slice the pie. Every kid in the classroom is having difficulty meeting at least some expectations. Some have longer lists of unsolved problems than others, but every kid in the classroom benefits when we are solving problems collaboratively and proactively, including the quote-unquote well-behaved ones. So when we are solving problems collaboratively and proactively, we're doing it with everybody. Second answer is that you can solve problems collaboratively with the entire class. There are some problems that affect every kid in the class. And there's a wonderful video in the What's New section on the Lives in the Balance website showing full class plan B. And this is where you are involving every kid in the classroom in the process of solving a problem that affects everybody in the classroom. It is very worth watching. And then thirdly, There's a lot of literature out there on how to build community in classrooms, in which we help each other, in which we support each other. These are communities in which the basic theme is, I got your back. If you have a strength, you are expected to help others. If you have a limitation, you have the expectation that you will receive help. Everybody needs help with something. Everybody's good enough at something to provide help. We are a community of learners. And that's how you help kids help kids.
Yeah, I was thinking, I mean, reading your book, one can't help but reflect on one's own childhood or the childhoods of the kids in your lives, whether they're your own kids or other kids. And one of the things that came up for me was the prevalence of emotions like humiliation and embarrassment. And kids are so, I mean, we're all vulnerable to those things, but kids are so vulnerable. But for one kid, it's academics. For another, like me, it might have been athletics. For another, it's social awkwardness. I mean, no, like, as you say, nobody can is sort of strong in all areas. And we can identify, if given half a chance, with everybody else's sense of vulnerability.
We could if we were running our classroom that way.
Yeah. So one of the things that I was also thinking about is our schools, which are different from the schools in other countries in so many ways, exist within our culture of crime and punishment, military discipline, mass incarceration. And your work really challenges that culture. When you introduce this model to schools, are you getting resistance from people who believe in those kind of fundamental philosophies?
The biggest thing I get in, sometimes I'll get philosophical reactions because what people are hearing differs from what they've been thinking for a very long time. But I find that those beliefs can be challenged. There's not a whole lot of meat on that bone often. I think it's mostly a matter of helping people be aware of the research, be aware of the limitations of rewarding and punishing. And by the way, the limitations of rewarding and punishing are before our very eyes. It's the same 10, 20, 30 kids in every building who are accounting for 80 to 90% of the discipline referrals in that building. So that's proof that it's not working. Sometimes, I forget the name of the book that you mentioned, but sometimes it's a matter of making clear what has been obvious for a very long time. Yes, we do live in a country that tends to be very punitive. Yes, that does find its way into our schools. But I haven't met a classroom teacher yet who wants to harm a kid. I haven't met a classroom teacher yet who wants to restrain or seclude a kid. I haven't met a classroom teacher yet who relishes the thought of being punitive with a kid. I think that these are interventions that are often acts of desperation because we're not sure exactly what to do instead. You know, a lot of my work has been oriented toward giving people things to do instead that are non-punitive, collaborative, proactive, and that work every bit as well, if not better, than what we've been doing all along. And to tell you the truth, aside from the time issue, which we help people get over the hump on, I find that there's more people who embrace this model than anything else because a lot of them are aware that what they're doing now isn't working well at all.
You're using the word proactive, and that is at the center of this model and this way of thinking. What do you recommend for teachers who are in an emergency situation in any given moment where that kid is angry and explosive?
We remind teachers that when you're using the assessment of lagging skills and unsolved problems, there are very few surprises left. And a problem is only a surprise the first time it happens. After that, it's not a surprise anymore. So if we were using the assessment of lagging skills and unsolved problems routinely to figure out what's really going on with this kid, instead of waiting for the behavior occurs yet again to try to reward or punish the kid, we'd be way ahead in the game. And we wouldn't have to use our crisis management strategies very often. But what we are mostly training teachers in is crisis management. Right. And the core of most crisis management programs is just simply defuse, de-escalate, keep everybody safe. We have to remember that defusing occurs very late in the game. De-escalating occurs very late in the game. Keeping everybody safe occurs very late in the game. It's a whole lot better to figure out what a kid's lagging skills and unsolved problems are ahead of time, proactively. But if a student should start acting up, you defuse, de-escalate, keep everybody safe, And then you figure out what you missed so that you don't have that scenario happen again in your classroom.
Give us some specific examples of lagging skills and unsolved problems.
Well, two of the ones that are most commonly checked off are difficulty handling transitions, shifting from one mindset or task to another. That's a lagging skill. Another lagging skill is difficulty persisting on challenging or tedious tasks. Unsolved problems that flow from difficulty handling transitions might be difficulty coming back into the classroom after recess, difficulty coming into school in the morning, difficulty keeping hands to self in the line from the classroom to lunch, things that might spring to mind on difficulty persisting on challenging or tedious tasks might be difficulty completing the double-digit division problems on the worksheet in math, difficulty completing the lab report in science. Those are unsolved problems. The lagging skills help us get the right lenses on. They help us stop saying things like attention-seeking, manipulative, coercive, unmotivated, limit testing. And the unsolved problems tell us the problems that need to be solved with this kid, because once they're solved, they're not going to be causing challenging behavior anymore, and we're not going to find ourselves in the heat of the moment anymore using our crisis management strategies to try to de-escalate or defuse a kid.
It seems like a lot of these so-called problem kids are actually the very children who have so much to contribute. You know, it's like they're highly energetic. So yeah, they're running in the halls. Well, that's just a sign of energy. They're highly sensitive. A lot of the autistic spectrum kids are intellectually brilliant. And losing them seems to be like a major loss to both the classroom and society.
It's really pretty tragic, especially since it's not that hard to identify and solve the problems that are causing the challenging behavior that is distracting us from the wonderful talents that these kids can bring to our classrooms and our society. It's really a waste of human potential. This is more an issue of commitment and turning around that rusting hulk of school discipline so that we are actually helping kids rather than simply being punitive.
So what is your hope for this work that you're doing? Is it getting incorporated, or are you working on getting it incorporated into teacher training in education schools, for example?
We are, but we also are trying to change things at the legislative level. We want to make it really difficult for schools to restrain or seclude a kid. That's already happened in inpatient psychiatry units and in residential facilities. Why it hasn't happened in schools yet is beyond me. We want to make it really difficult, if not impossible, to suspend or expel a kid. We want to make it impossible to paddle a kid at school. These are very counterproductive. We need to stop doing them. And that's legislative. That could be legal further down the road. At the very least, that's helping people understand that much of what we do in school discipline is very counterproductive, and that there are other options available to us that would be much more productive and also much more humane.
Yeah, it was kind of shocking to me to find out that the techniques used in those old-fashioned, horrifying psychiatric hospitals that they make like horror movies about became illegal in psychiatric hospitals but are still legal in schools.
Crazy when you think about it.
Yeah. So, okay, we hear about countries like Finland and many other countries that have these amazing school systems. Are they already using the kinds of methods that you're talking about?
You know, I think that the reason we point to them as amazing is academics, not necessarily behavior. You know, I speak over there a fair amount. Over in Scandinavia, they are just as interested in learning more about collaborative and proactive solutions as anywhere else. So it seems to me that many other countries still have a long way to go when it comes to how they treat their behaviorally challenging kids as we do. A lot of why we think those are great school systems is because of what they're accomplishing academically.
Interesting. Do men and women, teachers and administrators, for example, take equally to these methods?
I have not noticed a gender difference in receptivity to this model.
I'm also asking because in your work, a lot of the kids you feature, not all, but the majority are boys. Are boys having more troubles in school?
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, if we were to be diagnostic about it, is because of the male preponderance of ADHD. You know, when we look at a lot of the work that's been done looking at differences between boys and girls, sometimes we find that what's expected in a school classroom is better suited to girls than boys in terms of what they're walking in the door with. Of course, that's very general. But that male predominance in ADHD, when we look at ADHD as the precursor to many other difficulties kids have, that may account for quite a bit of it. You know what? Males are more active often. They are less attentive often. They are more impulsive often. That leads to oppositional behavior. And when we handle all of that poorly, it leads to all kinds of bad stuff.
And I think that really points to the limit of, as you say, and as you write about, diagnoses. Because when you put a label of ADHD on somebody, it doesn't tell you what the root of that problem is. We recently talked to Dr. Bruce Perry on this program, and he was talking about all these kids who are slapped with the label of ADHD when what's really going on is some kind of undiagnosed trauma. When you do the kind of work that you're doing with kids and they come out of their problems and their defiance and so on, do they tend to have less need for medication?
Well, I guess the way I put it is the vast majority of kids who I've worked with who ended up with a diagnosis of ADHD did not have trauma histories. Some did. The main thing for me is that ADHD doesn't tell you anything about a kid's lagging skills and unsolved problems. Doesn't tell you what skills that kid with ADHD is lacking. Doesn't tell you what expectations that kid with ADHD is having difficulty meeting. All ADHD really is, when you look at the diagnostic manual, is a label describing a cluster of behaviors that the diagnostic manual says often occur together. But there are many, many different pathways that could lead a kid to exhibit those behaviors and therefore to that label. There's nothing to replace the fact that we got to figure out what this kid's lagging skills and unsolved problems are. Once we figure that out, then the main benefit of having a diagnosis is that it's the gatekeeper on services and placement and funding, which is obsolete all by itself, but sort of a byproduct of the way we've always done things. I do find, and I don't have data for this yet, that when you are solving problems collaboratively and proactively, you don't need medicine as much as you did, especially in many kids, but certainly it's not going to be all.
What if the kid's unsolved problem is that he's so energetic that he needs to run around all day, which I have to say is kind of how we evolved as Homo sapiens, is running around. We didn't evolve to sit at desks.
Well, when you are solving that problem collaboratively, you are getting the kid's input on what's making it difficult for him to meet our expectation, which is presumably sitting still at his desk in the classroom all day. We are then putting the adult's concern on the table, why we think it's important that the kid sit at his desk, or at least not disturb the students around him. And then we are coming up with a solution together. And what's interesting is there are solutions to that, that adults and kids can agree on. And it may be that the kid's not going to have to sit at his desk all day, so long as he's not disturbing the kids around him, and so long as he's getting his work done. So, you know what's fascinating? There are solutions to these problems, and it's not always medicine.
You mentioned that what's going on at home is not something that you can necessarily deal with. And if there are severe problems at home from violence and addiction and abuse and so on, but there are also parents who are just, they're not violent, they're not abusive, but they're just stressed and they want to help. They are limited in time. What is the role of parents in this work? Does it help if they play a role?
Absolutely. And my comment earlier was not that there's not ways to help those parents. It's just that sometimes schools are not in the ideal position to do that. But if schools have open arms and if schools are inviting parents in to show them what they're doing, you can actually have an impact on what's going on at home. One of the things I frequently say is that the unsolved problems at home and the unsolved problems at school tend not to overlap that much. Parents don't need the school's help on the fact that the kid is having difficulty brushing his teeth before he goes to bed at night. And the school actually does not need the parents' help on the fact that the kid is having difficulty coming back into the classroom after recess. Those are separate realms. So it's not that there's not help for parents. We want parents solving problems collaboratively and proactively at home. We want the folks at school solving problems collaboratively and proactively. If we can't get the folks at home to do it, then at least we have the folks at school doing it. If we can't get the folks at school to do it, then at least we have the folks at home doing it. We're looking for good somewhere. Would it be ideal if we could have parents involved in what we're trying to do at school and learning as much about it as possible? Yeah, that's sort of like nirvana.
How did you get into this work?
Well, I went to graduate school in clinical psychology, started working primarily with kids with ADHD. When you work with kids who have ADHD, you're going to be working with a lot of kids who have oppositional defiant disorder. That became the type of kid that really intrigued me. And that's when I started noticing that a lot of what we often do to kids who are defiant and non-compliant and refusing to do what they're told wasn't working and that we needed a different approach.
Dr. Ross Green, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And at the Radio Cafe, we're so happy to thank our sponsors for this program, the Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation, the Lannan Foundation, the Lenzig Performing Arts Center, and the Santa Fe Institute. Thanks for making this show possible. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Growing local teachers and cultivating educational leadership, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. The Radio Cafe and the Santa Fe New Mexican thank the Lannan Foundation for their support. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
for a long time.